Hi, I'm Mary.
And I'm Christy.
And we're angel investors in Budapest, working together on FinTech Factory, an early-stage fintech investment fund backed by MKB Bank.
Each month, we get together to talk about investments and innovation in the financial sector and beyond with experts from around the world.
So Mike Siegel is here with us today. Mike is a former serial entrepreneur who made the transition to investor, advisor, and most recently, author. Over his 30-year career, Mike has founded 7 startups with 3 exits, including an IPO. He's served as a general partner of 500 Startups FinTech Fund, responsible for fundraising, early-stage investments in over 80 fintech startups globally, and building out 500's fintech support ecosystem. Mike now spends his time helping banks and other institutions achieve excellence in innovation, ecosystem development, and venture investing. He also helps startup founders become better leaders and accelerate strategy, organizational development, and fundraising. Most recently, Mike founded 20022 Labs, a not-for-profit trade association, and Tracking Payments, a newsletter focused on data-rich payments and embedded finance. Mike is one of the folks I know from Silicon Valley that loves speaking to startups, investors, and innovators around the world. Knowing he loves Budapest, back in 2018, I invited him to visit us here at FinTech Lab, and he made a big impact, so we're really excited to have him join us today. So, Mike, thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure.
So, Mary, it's my pleasure.
So, you are a busy guy, and you've had an amazing career. Why don't you tell us a little bit in your own words about your journey from entrepreneur to investor and kind of how you got into the things that you're working on today?
Well, I guess it started back in university when I had my first sort of internship for a real job and realized that I'd never really wanted a real job. And at the same time, a friend of mine from school asked me to help him with a project that turned into our first company, which was clip art and game development. And I sort of got addicted. And I am, it's true. Back when desktop publishing was a thing and the first Apple laser printer came out. And I just sort of got addicted to that creative process of, you know, finding an idea, doing what we now call customer development, which is, you know, shaping the idea according to what the market needs, gathering up a team. I just kind of love that. And that's how I've spent most of my career until at some point in the not, you know, terribly distant past, I realized I was ready to move from doer to teacher, advisor, which is what had me move from being an entrepreneur into an investor and now advisor. My sort of journey for fintech was that one of the gigs that I had between startups was helping out SWIFT, the global payment network, develop their innovation program, which was called Innotribe, around putting together fintech startups and SWIFT member banks. And it was sort of at that moment I got what turned out to be the last startup idea I had, which was for a company called Cashflower.
This is around when you and I met, I think. This was in 2015,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah.
The first
exactly.
time you were in Budapest, or we were in Budapest together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, that's right. I think I gave a talk about managing cash flow in Budapest, didn't I?
Yeah. It was that startup adventure program, which was actually huge for the ecosystem. So, and I'm still getting value out of you. So it was great.
I'm still getting value out of you. It was awesome. So basically what I learned from the SWIFT engagement was there's another big shift happening, which now we all call fintech. And the way that I wanted to play was to try and solve one of my own repeated problems, which was how do I better manage cash flow for my startups or my small business? With that idea, I went to a friend of mine, a guy named Dave McClure, who was the founder of 500 Startups, and said, look, I'd really love to use your growing portfolio as a beta test group. He introduced me to the guy that he had just brought in to build 500 Startups FinTech Fund, a terrific investor named Sheel Manat. And Sheel said, well, come on as my entrepreneur in residence and you can do whatever you want. When I figured out I didn't want to grow Cashflower, he said, well, why don't you join me as a partner? And that's how I became an investor.
So you pitched 500 Startups. You were trying to get them kind of as a customer. You were trying to get free, you know, testing
for
Cashflower.
Yeah, I wanted them as a channel.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you
I wanted a way to do my customer development faster.
Yeah. So, and then they're like, how about you do our fintech fund instead? Eventually.
Well, no. Yes, eventually that's what Sheil said was, well, okay, so that doesn't work and I don't know what you're going to do, but maybe you want to be a partner in the fund. And then I helped with, you know, helping to raise the fund and making the investments. And I took the experience that I had working with all the banks at Swift and helped create a platform, if you will, to help our fintech startups go faster with more than just money, right? Relationships with banks and payment networks and lawyers and fintech focused investors and all of that. So I helped build that ecosystem out.
Awesome. So yeah, let's talk about your time at 500. So it must have been super exciting. So what was it like making investment decisions there?
Well, I'd only been on the entrepreneur side of the table before I started. So, you know, the initial thing is it was mind-boggling to see, you know, how the sausage is made inside of VCs. And I'm super lucky to have had a great team of people helping me, you know, sort of learn the ropes as I was an EIR. I think the first thing that I noticed was having a clarity of purpose with the fintech fund was super helpful. You know, our thesis was financial services for the rest of us. So we wanted to look at companies that would basically lower the cost of delivering financial services to more people around the world. And having that clarity was really helpful for the next piece. One of the advantages that 500 has with their sort of global brand and their accelerator structure is that, you know, every 6 months we would do a call for applications and we would get thousands of fintech applications from around the world. And so it was a flood of information that you had to weed through. But the really cool thing was that we got to see at a moment in time all the ideas from all over the world about what's the next thing in fintech from really smart, you know, aggressive entrepreneurs. And so that, first of all, gave us a picture of what's hot in the market, like what hasn't been done yet. And it allowed us effectively to benchmark what does good performance look like in this new kind of company. And so the process was laborious because you wanted to talk to all these people and you wanted to hear all of these insights. But the process of actually picking should we invest in company A versus company B was pretty easy.
And you had the benefit of being able to kind of, yeah, see all of the approaches to a particular topic, right? So
that's right.
And I think we've talked about this before, and I think that's also really unique. So you're not just thinking, okay, I kind of want to, you know, I know this is going to be big. Let me look for a couple companies. You get hundreds of companies coming to you and you can kind of see what themes emerge and the different approaches and then really make kind of a, you know, bird's eye view approach about what companies you want to, you know, you're going to put your bet on, right?
Absolutely. Like you might have, I don't know, 10 companies show up in one application set that's going to do institutional crypto custody, right? And each entrepreneur has a slightly different background. They have different perspectives on why that's going to be a thing. They have different journeys that got them there. They have different progress that they've made trying it a bunch of different ways. And so you're able to tell, well, is crypto custody going to be a thing? Is it, you know, because of the individual entrepreneur or is it because the market's ready? You're able to see that. You're able to see that now is not the right time. So we're not going to invest in that theme at all. And then when you look at here's a company in, you know, Eastern Europe and here's a company in Southeast Asia and here's a company in the US, and you can see which one is actually doing a better job bringing the idea to market. So let's invest in that one. So
and, it's, yeah, pick the
you know,
first
you get
mover.
To see the the most efficient or effective one. It's not, right, because I've got 10 first movers in front of me all doing this thing.
The one at the front of the pack,
but I get
basically.
To see, you know,
yeah.
that there's, because there's 10, there's all of these smart people putting energy on this problem. I think solving the problem is going to be a thing. So that's the first one, the momentum in the market. And then which team is performing best? That's which investment am I going to make? So I both got to see the problem and how people are doing it, the solution, which is a really you know, wonderful position as a VC, because usually you don't, you have one, but not the other, and you might not have either. You just have a lot of elbow grease that you put in to try and make a great investment. So it was a really interesting initiation in venture capital.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you've been in a very privileged position of being able to compare companies against each other. But can you tell us, like, what do you think are the biggest trends in fintech right now, looking at all of these applications and startups out there?
Well, to be clear, I'm no longer actively investing for 500, but I am seeing, you know, through my startup advisory work and the work I'm doing with 2022 Labs and tracking payments, I do see a lot of stuff. So what has me most excited right now is, I guess you'd call it the next generation after open banking, it's embedded finance, which is the idea that non-financial services companies, non-banks, are going to integrate financial services under their brands. And if you were to think about Uber in one fashion, that you get in a car and you get out of a car where you want to go without ever touching a credit card or cash, Uber is embedding financial services in its customer experience. Now, when you look at Amazon or Shopify or a number of others, there's financial services for merchants and customers on those marketplaces. Where I think that's all going is every non-financial services company has an opportunity to deliver financial services. And that's both on the B2C side and on the B2B side. And I think that's super exciting, right? That expands what it means, what the financial services industry means, and it changes the terms and customer experience in which financial services are delivered. It makes good banks invisible. I think that's a really big thing. And it's not just banks, right? Insurance firms as well.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, people are always thinking about how you define fintech. And I've kind of jokingly said, well, everybody's a fintech because as long, you know, you're taking payments from somebody. So at the end of the day, there's, you know, going to be some sort of financial transaction here. But yeah, it's the whole payments industry, I think, is really interesting in how this has changed. And I know you launched a newsletter that's exactly on this topic. So what can you tell us? What's your high level, you know, for people tuning in who don't know so much about this space, what's going on in the payments world today and how has this changed over the past few years?
Yeah, so the newsletter is called Tracking Payments. It's at trackingpayments.org.
We'll put a link to it in our show notes.
Oh, super. Thank you. And with 2022 Labs, we engaged a lot with banks and national payment rails and the, you know, big incumbent technology companies that make payments technology. And what we found after interacting with them is that, you know, if you are in a global transaction banking role at a big bank, or you're selling a payment system for some payment system vendor, you really don't spend a whole lot of time looking at what's going on in venture investment and new startups and all of that. So what we wanted to do with the newsletter was try and, it's basically a news digest that looks at investment and partnership and other news that existing executives just don't have time to digest, and put it together in a way that will help them understand why this investment or that partnership or that acquisition is actually going to have an impact on their business and what they can do about it. So in payments, which has just skyrocketed as a result of COVID, right? You need more digital payments in order to do more digital e-commerce, and there you go. Investment and acquisition has been crazy over the last year, and big incumbent organizations have had to invest in going more digital more quickly, getting rid of checks or making sure that there's, you know, real-time distribution of funds or these kinds of things. And what's been really interesting is that what you see is that payments, right? Payments is something that everyone on the planet has to do. It's like truly the lingua franca, the global lingua franca. And when you add to a payment message, here's the money, data about what that payment message is for, the invoice number, the bill of materials that you just bought from Amazon or whatever it is, you get one set of messages that allow you to do everything else instead of separate messages of here's the invoice and here's the payment. So that is really cool. That is a perspective on building, it's the next internet, right? It's an internet for transactions because it includes the payments and it includes what the payments are for.
So this is like metadata on pictures.
This is metadata.
So you can think about it that way. So, and this is what the ISO standard is all about, right? Defining how to incorporate these properties or...
Exactly. And I tend to have a bit of a B2B bent to how I view the world. And so, and this even goes back to what I was trying to do with Cashflower. When you have the payment and you have the data, when you think about the corporation who has to pay or be paid, they need to integrate a payment into their business process very efficiently. I need to know when I'm going to receive money. I have to do cash flow forecasting on it. I have to know when to send money back out. And so what you're beginning to see is a reshaping of what I refer to as the CFO stack. So what's the technology and the business processes that the people responsible for managing a company's money, how do we make their lives easier? And that's something that's being driven by the corporation, not the banks who provide, you know, the services, which are effectively commoditized and are built to be convenient for the bank to deliver, as opposed to being built to be easy for the customer, which is the corporation, to consume. And that's a huge shift that's going on now as well.
So Mike, tell us more about your work with banks. What banks are you working with now and what do you do for them?
So I help banks and other corporations improve their capital efficiency with their innovation investments by helping them to understand and leverage the lessons of how the venture capital industry has grown up to support high-performing startups, which effectively are innovation projects. So I help them in a number of different ways. With sometimes it's setting up investment programs, sometimes it's around cultural change and training to be more effective at entrepreneurship, building their own businesses, their own digital businesses. And one of the banks that I've been working with now for quite a while is Standard Chartered Bank, which is a global bank operating in both developed and emerging markets around the world. I started working with them way back when I was working with Swift, or I got to know them then, and I've been working with them for about the last 3 years. And currently, I sit on as an independent investment committee member for their corporate venture capital fund, which sits inside of a group called SC Ventures, which is sort of their arm for managing innovation for the bank.
Okay, so there's a corporate VC, and they also have kind of a venture building activity, I think you mentioned, right?
Yeah, so the SC Ventures, which the mission of SC Ventures is to rewire the DNA of banking. And it's supported from the board on down and from, you know, the base company on up. And they have three pillars to their activities. One, they call Accelerator, which is about engaging everyone at the bank in figuring out through technology how to improve the bank's performance. And that's both a cultural change and a performance enhancement exercise. They have a pillar that they call Ventures, which is about building new business models for banking that they often do in partnership with third parties. So for example, they've built a small business marketplace, they've built a crypto custody solution, they've built a new payments network, a number of different things. And then they have a VC arm that makes investments into technology companies which are useful to the bank. And I've worked with each of those three groups as an advisor, and now I work in depth with the VC arm.
And what's the mandate, or what kind of companies are they looking for on the VC side?
So the thesis is to invest in enterprise-ready technology companies that can be useful to the bank including those ventures I mentioned. So we look at a lot of data and security and enterprise infrastructure. We don't look at new financial services. We invest at, generally speaking, Series B and later, and possibly a little unique to CVC, we invest in companies that already have commercial agreements with the bank. So the technology startups have, you know, gone through the process of demonstrating that they have value to the bank, that they know how to solve a bank's problem, that they know how to do it at enterprise scale. And as the VC arm, it helps us really to accelerate due diligence and understand right. whether the company it can get big serving other enterprises of the scale of Standard Chartered.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we've kind of taken almost the opposite approach in FinSec Lab in our early years. We would invest in companies and then try to sell them to the bank. But yeah, I think that's really cool to do it the other way around, where you already had a time to get to know them. You already believe in their value proposition because you've been a customer. So you've kind of validated that piece also. And then, yeah, why not put a little money in, take some equity and be a great reference for them and, you know, get a piece of the bigger pie. Yeah, that's really cool. I like that approach.
Well, and it really allows, you know, as the fund, it allows us to truly help accelerate the company. One of the things I love about how Standard Chartered's approached it is they understand what, as a bank, their unique value add is. Hmm. So they have us, meaning the independent advisors around the table, to help keep them aligned with what the venture industry does and is supposed to do. But as the bank, as an investor, they'll work on new use cases, right? They'll look at new markets. They'll bring our companies to the bank's customers. You know, a really great thing that they did when we had the downturn at the beginning of COVID was, instead of putting more money into any of the companies, the investment team went back to the bank to find more use cases and potentially more revenue for the portfolio company. So it really positions the bank very well as an investor. You said something at the beginning, about how you guys approach it. So to be clear, the accelerator group and even the ventures will look at earlier stage technology companies as potential collaborators, but our fund doesn't get involved until there's a commercial agreement.
Yeah, makes sense. So based on your experience and your work, is there any advice that you have for banks that are trying to innovate? I know that each bank is different, and you kind of mentioned that, you know, one of the things SC does well is understand what they can bring to the table as a bank. And I think there's some great wisdom there too. But you've been part of entrepreneurship programs. I think a big part of the issue tends to be cultural. You know, culture is everything, right? And it's hard to change and to really kind of move quicker and in this direction of digitalization. Obviously, COVID was a big push in this direction, but what other kind of takeaways have you learned from your time working with several different kind of banks? What tends to work, or what's your advice for banks that are trying to really be leading the pack here?
So I'll use SC again as an example, but there are lots of other examples of banks who have done these couple of things really well. The first one is having a real clear purpose to your investment and innovation objectives. You know, again, with Standard Chartered, they say SC Ventures, the job is to rewire the DNA of banking. They realize they can't do that uniformly across everything, which is why they've split into these pillars of, we're going to do stuff to improve the performance and the culture of the bank. That's one objective. We're going to do stuff to experiment in what new banking business models should look like. That's ventures. And we're going to do stuff where we can learn how technology companies grow and get to the inside of some of the things technologically that we don't know. Like, what does it mean, next generation data management? Or what does quantum computing mean to an institution like ours? So they know they want to rewire the bank. That's a message which is supported from the board on down. And it's clear enough that everyone can understand what the innovation group is set up to do. Like, why, what's its purpose? And it's not a threat to the existing business. It's assurance that the bank is going to be competitive, you know, for the next 100 years or whatever it is. So that that clarity is one. All layers of management understand what's going on. That's another really important thing.
Non-trivial.
And then the, absolutely mission critical.
Yeah.
Absolutely mission critical. And then the other thing that they've done well, and again, some other banks have done well as well, is they don't depend only on the talent in the bank. They know for new behaviors, new skill sets, right? How do you build a startup? How do you get it funded? How am I supposed to compensate people that are working on projects that are likely to fail? They don't depend on themselves alone, they go to outside sources. So, right, they brought in myself and two other real VCs to be part of the governance of their fund. Or when they set up one of their ventures, they'll have people who are subject matter experts from within the bank, and then they'll recruit outside product people or CEOs or what have you to be part of those venture teams as well. So it's understanding that the DNA we have today is not sufficient, and we don't have time to wait to just evolve our own DNA. We need outside help, support, influence, who are practitioners, not consultants.
Yeah. And so it's not just rewiring the DNA technologically, but even with the human resource side. So they're bringing in that expertise and putting them, you know, you're part of the team. So you're a really active player in the whole story. You're not just a consultant who's going to sit back, but you're actually playing an active role.
Yes. Yeah, the short answer is yes. It depends on who you look at. But yes, they'll bring in people to be entrepreneurs in residence to work on some of the ventures, for example.
Yeah.
One of my other clients, which is a big consulting services firm, we act as coaches to their entrepreneurial teams that are trying to build asset-based businesses instead of services-based businesses. So yes, they could learn how to be a great entrepreneur, but just like the companies we used to invest in for 500 startups, we would coach them a lot on how to be a great entrepreneur so that they could learn faster and execute faster. That's another example of bringing in outside talent to help accelerate your journey of what's really the most important part is the culture and the practices, not the technology. The technology is actually, and forgive me all the technologists who are listening, it's relatively easy. Right? New technology is easy. New behaviors is really hard.
I like that.
So they put, so the top level advice is remember new behaviors are really hard and everything you can do to evolve new behaviors, you should do.
Yeah. Coming back to startups, over the course of your career, you've seen hundreds, if not thousands of startups. So what's your advice to companies when they're approaching VCs? Like how can they stand out?
I said earlier in our conversation that, you know, as the investor for 500, I was really blessed because I got to see both market momentum and startup momentum as independent things. I don't care what startup you're working on, you're not alone. There are millions of smart people who are also seeing the same problem as you. So that's the first thing is have a little bit of humility, if you will, about the fact that you're not the only person working to solve this problem, but you need to be working on it in a unique way and it needs to express itself in your execution. The second thing is don't for a moment underestimate the importance of storytelling, because whether you're talking to investors or you're talking to customers or you're talking to potential team members, they're all humans and they all react to stories and they need to see the big idea as well as the data. In fact, at early stages, the big idea is even more important than the numbers because you don't really have numbers to communicate. So learning to tell stories passionately is super important. And then I think when it comes to fundraising in particular, you as the entrepreneur, you think your job is building a product and selling a product. But when you're trying to raise money, you're not selling your product, you're selling your equity. And just like you have to learn a whole lot about how customers think and work to be successful at selling your product, you have a whole lot of work to do to understand the business model of investors and what makes them tick. And not just the business model, but their emotional model as well. What are the things that keep them up at night? What are the things that they worry about? When you dig a couple layers down, what you realize is that, especially at the early stage, that you will be a big win or that you might be a big win is not actually that important compared to you are working in a way right now that will make sure you get the next round of funding after the money that I might give you runs out. So the chances that you'll be a big win are really, really slim. The best way to optimize whether you'll be a big win or not, or have a shot at becoming a big win, is by making sure you'll get the next round of funding. So that's more about your execution than it is about the market size.
Yeah, you had a nice take on early stage investing when we were speaking last time. Could you share that here as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I don't pretend to be the first one to say this, but I found it useful, is that early stage investing is momentum investing masquerading as fundamental investing.
And what do we mean by that?
Yeah. So I talked about the story and the market and all of that. When an investor is thinking about investing, the first thing that they're trying to think about is whether they want to invest in that theme or that market, not that company. Right? So I have to know that the market is moving before I will invest. That's the momentum. Then often investors, they need a way to explain why they invested in the company that they invested in. And so they start digging for layers of data, any data that they can lay their hands on that says this particular company is the one that's going to win in this theme, right? But at the early stages, there is no data. There's
right.
Like there's virtually no data. You can't, right? It's super hard. So you might say, I'm investing based on the data. And when, say, a startup gets that comment from a VC of, well, we'll just see how it develops or a little bit, or you don't have enough traction, that's actually an indication that you haven't made a strong enough case for the momentum versus the data. Because if they really believe in the idea and your ability to explain the idea to them, then they'll invest in you. You're a good bet.
Because you'll make the traction happen because this market's going to take off. So, yeah.
That's right. And then, you know, as things progress, then there's more and more data available. And your job as the entrepreneur is to present the right data at the right time to convince the investor that you continue to be the right horse to bet on.
Okay. So another thing that's not yours, but I learned from you and I think is really a cool concept, is this philosophy of lines, not dots. Do you want to explain that a little bit, and how do you find that relevant?
Sure. So that the invest in lines, not dots, is an article written by a VC in Los Angeles named Mark Suster, and I recommend every company I talk to go read it. But the idea about that, and I think we even may have approached it from this angle when we talked about it, was, you know, if you're seeking a life partner, you don't walk into a bar and say, hey, you're cute, would you like to get married?
Right.
You date. And that's a process of getting to know each other and how you react to the world over time. A good investor will not see a start, you know, despite what you might read in TechCrunch, a good investor will not meet a startup for the first time and give them an overpriced round. They want to see how you do at dealing with problems, generating data, how you're going to recruit people, how you're going to raise funds, how you're going to deal with problems with customers or with team members, and they want to do it over a period of time. That's part of the question, not should I invest in this market, but should I invest in this company and this team? And so you have to understand from an entrepreneur's perspective, when it comes time to talking to an investor, you need to present them the facts of how you have performed over a period of time, not what's happened yesterday.
Well, and I also use this kind of to say, you know, it's totally okay to fundraising, first of all, I think is something that's kind of a full-time part of a startup's life in the early stage. So, you know, even if you just closed around, you got to be keeping your eye out on the next thing because it's, you know, your runway is going to be out before you know it. And the idea that you can approach an investor, even if it's a little bit of a reach, you know, and just be humble, like you said, and just say, hey, I'd love to establish a relationship. We're too early for you, but here's why I think we might be a fit in 6 months. And I'm going to come back to you and show you what I've achieved between now and then. That's a hell of a lot stronger pitch than just waiting until, you know, you're at that point and say, take my word for it. Like building that kind of, giving them those data points that they can connect over time. So you're building that traction for yourself, you know, in the story by kind of starting these relationships even earlier, maybe than they're.
Well, you're even more importantly, you're building trust.
Right.
That you do or exceed what you say you're going to do. I guess the thing I would add to what you said, I don't disagree with any of it, is that fundraising is one of two things that a CEO does, right? A CEO doesn't build product. A CEO gets team members. That's job one. And job two is make sure team members have resources they need to execute the company's vision, which is called fundraising. So and that's all a good CEO does. I mean, they may have to do other stuff until they hire team members, but basically set a vision, you get resources to execute on that vision, right? And that's all you're supposed to do. So the idea of maintaining relationships with customers, with potential investors, with all of those folks, that is the CEO's full-time job. That's what they need to be doing. So you're right. And it is so important that one of the first questions, sort of unspoken questions that VCs ask themselves about a CEO is, does this CEO understand what their job is? Will they be able to raise this round of funding and the next round of funding if they don't take their job of, my job is get team, get resources, seriously enough, they don't invest?
Yeah, I think that's really true. And it's funny when you see the guys who have the passion and they hack together the prototype and then they realize I'm not even working on the product anymore. I'm just getting the right people in place and steering the ship and getting resources. And it's an interesting transition to see too sometimes in people.
And sometimes it's not right for everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny. I'm working with one company right now where the CEO is realizing that they rather be in the product. And so we're talking about, well, how do you hire an outside CEO?
Wow. Yeah.
Right? They're like, I love product. I don't love X, Y, and Z. I got the company this far. Maybe it's time to transition myself into the role that I love.
Yeah.
Rather than push myself to do stuff I don't love. And as a result, let down team members or customers or investors or whatever. Amazing wisdom from this particular CEO in self-knowledge.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Mike. This was awesome. I think we covered a lot of ground. We'd love to have you back at some point. And good luck to you and everything that you're doing. I'm excited to keep in touch and follow the progress and waiting for our next Budapest trip when you can get back out here.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait to travel again. Listen, Mary, it's my pleasure. I think what you and Christy are doing is awesome. And anything I can do to support you and your community, I'd love to.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Mike.
Bye, Mike.
Bye.
Thanks for listening.
Tune in next month for another episode of Beyond FinTech, where we discuss the latest trends in investing and innovation in the financial sector and beyond.